Hi, I'm Dan, and welcome to another episode of Onward Upward, a podcast produced by the Multicultural Bible Ministry. We're a church based in Western Sydney, and we love the fact that God is in the business of transforming lives. Whether you call MBM home, or whether you're a guest and been recommended to subscribe to our podcast, we're so glad to have you with us today. At the time of recording, the country of Italy had recorded just over 32,000 deaths from coronavirus. Wow. And today we're going to hear from one family from our church who happened to be holidaying in Italy just moments before the country went into lockdown. This interview with Mark and Joanne Boydell could well have been recorded from Italy had it not been for God graciously allowing them to escape this country in the nick of time. But more than hearing a journey about their escape from Italy, we're going to hear many, many things that God has been teaching this family on a roller coaster over the last 12 months. Whether that's Joanne's journey with postnatal depression, whether that's hearing the news suddenly of a parent on the other side of the world who suffers major bleeding in the brain and hops on a plane expecting to attend her funeral, to hearing about what life was like in Niger, not Nigeria, but Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world, along with the threat of two nasty terrorist groups surrounding him. Well, with that being said, I'm sure you're ready to get stuck in. So let's get started. Well, Mark and Joanne Boydell, so good to have you on the podcast today.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Now, you guys have been part of MBM for a little over 2.5 years mainly at the 10:45 service, although given your shift work, sometimes you pop into the other services, which is, I guess, part of the flexibility, isn't it, of doing church at multiple times on Sunday?
Yeah.
Tell us, now that we're all online, when do you normally check in and watch church online?
Usually it's when our son's either having his morning nap or once he's gone to bed for the evening.
Yeah, and that's one of the beauties of church online is that it's very flexible and you can press play whenever you are able to.
Yeah, whenever you've got free time pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us something that you've missed about not physically gathering together.
I would say I've missed the social element of actually seeing and talking to people in person.
Yeah, and I've missed having cups of tea made for me.
We've got a wonderful morning tea team who make a good cuppa. But yes, they're very servant-hearted, and we miss seeing one another. Now, just some quick get-to-know-you questions before we launch. Tell us a little bit about your family, Joanne.
So my parents are from Syria. They migrated here many years ago. They're culturally Christian, but never really grew up or never really took me to church that often.
And how about yourself, Mark?
So my parents, British, but they met in Africa and they brought me up in France. So they both worked as missionaries. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I love a good French accent. So, Mark, speak some French for us, please.
Bonsoir. Je suis très heureux d'être sur cette émission et j'espère que vous allez réussir à apprendre quelque chose.
Right. I had no idea what you said, but it sounded good. Jeez, that sounds good. Do you want to give us a translation?
Oh, you want a translation?
Yes. Hopefully, if it's not offensive.
I said, no, it wasn't offensive. It was a good evening. I'm very happy to be on this program and I hope you learn something from it.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent. Now, you've also got in your immediate family, you've got a boy and another one on the way. How old is your son?
Almost 13 months now, and his brother is due in 6 weeks. So it'll be a very close age gap between the two.
Wow. Okay. All right. And just happens to be, I mean, you've chosen the right name for the firstborn because my son is the same name, Elijah. And feel free to call your next son Daniel as well in honor of this podcast.
It was a name we'll consider.
Well, there you go. We heard it here first. Okay. Now, tell us, just to get to know you guys a bit more, Mark, what's a favorite artist of yours, music or... otherwise,
it would be Tom Waits. To say, so I'm not sure he's very well known, but he's
okay. And Joanne, tell us your favorite way to relax.
It's actually having a bath with some nice scented candles and like a bath bomb.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Makes Mark's job very easy when you know when he knows that he just has to make a bath for you.
If only he did it more often.
He will after this podcast now that it's public. And Joanne, tell us how you guys met.
So we actually met at the hospital. We were both working at Nepean. And I was very impressed with his resuscitation skills and at taking control of a really stressful situation and remaining calm throughout.
Okay. And so, this is with Mark. So Mark works as a doctor, as a surgeon, and you're a midwife.
I was an intensive care nurse.
Wonderful. Before. Okay. So you met in the course of an emergency. And Mark, tell us about the proposal.
It was a very matter-of-fact proposal, I suppose. It was, we're both in a relationship on the basis that we were going to get married. So there's no pressure in that situation. So thankfully things did work out in that way. So
you knew she was going to say yes?
Yeah, yeah. There was never any doubt. I don't actually know how it happened. There was never any... So I'm not the most romantic person, clearly, and it was very matter-of-fact that we kind of...
You did ask for my dad's permission.
Oh, yeah, I did ask for her dad's
very
permission.
Very traditional.
Yeah. Good work. Had you bought the ring already without Joanne knowing?
No. So Joanne had already organised what ring she wanted, so,
I
didn't have to mess anything up, so
nice.
That was great.
Safe bet. Nice. Okay, well, let's find out more about how you guys came to know Jesus individually. Mark, you were saying before that you obviously grew up in a Christian home and your parents... though British, ended up working in France, teaching French to missionaries who were trying to share the gospel with others in France.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you were there since the age of 5 right through up until 18. Now, talk us through how you came to accept Jesus for yourself.
I think because I was brought up in a situation, so I lived at the school that my parents were running. There was always about 60 or so missionaries who are always perceived to have very, very, very strong faiths. And so I was always brought up around people who were following what God wanted them to do. But I think it also made it slightly harder for me to find a faith of my own, in the sense that because it was always around me, it's very hard to really know, is this your faith or is it just the cultural or social background you've been brought up in? So when I went off to university at age 18, I went through quite a long period of just deconstructing everything I had believed in because of my background from my parents, to really go from piece to piece, starting back at zero, quite a painful experience of just removing everything that has structured you and starting from scratch and trying to figure out, is God real? You know, what's the evidence for Christ's existence? And so it took me up until about the age of 29, so for about 10 years of deconstructing my faith and reconstructing it, 10 to 15 years of doing that. Up until the point, there was no kind of bolt of lightning or anything like that, but when I kind of finally put all the pieces back together again, I could say, okay, I own this. This is my faith. This is something that I'm happy to die on a hill for. And to allow it to change my life and to change me through it.
Yeah. I really appreciate you sharing the depth of that and the fact that you basically did start back at ground zero, even though you had the blessing of growing up in a Christian home, just that act of journeying and wrestling to make sure that you knew what you believed and you really believed it. Yeah. Joanne, you mentioned before that you grew up in kind of a church-going home or a religious home. Can you give us a bit more detail about how you came to know Jesus for yourself?
Yeah, so even though my parents were culturally Christian, they weren't really taking us to church regularly. And I always grew up with this strong sense of what was right and wrong. And I suppose most of my teenage and young adult life, I was quite agnostic and didn't really believe in anything or didn't really believe in God until I actually met Mark. And he gave me the book by C.S. Lewis called Mere Christianity, which did help explain a lot of where my sense of morality was coming from, and that it did actually, it was actually based off the values of the Christian faith. So then it all made sense to me, and that's how I refound my faith again.
Yeah, so just knowing that there's an objective truth, that there's something else, someone else calling the shots about what's right, what's wrong.
Yeah.
So like that was helpful for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, you know, what you would be believing in would be different from what I'm believing in, and we would have different views of what's right and wrong. We could just live a life our own way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Excellent. Now, Joanne, you were mentioning before that you used to work in intensive care as a nurse.
Yep.
But you've since made the move over to midwifery. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, so I actually worked in intensive care for a really long time, and I was getting to the point where I was struggling with sort of the suffering that I was seeing in intensive care, and I wanted a change. I was starting to burn out, and so I thought that perhaps doing midwifery, where I'm at the complete opposite end of the spectrum, and instead, rather than seeing patients suffering and dying, I'd be seeing babies born and families happy. And yeah, so that's why I decided to sort of make that switch. And I actually thought that having both intensive care experience and midwifery experience would be useful if we ever were to work overseas, sort of in Africa, if we decided to go there in the future. So it's two very handy skills to have.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And Mark, tell us about your journey into being, you're also in the medical field, a surgeon, but it feels like, I guess with any medical study, it feels like you're doing a lot more studying, especially in the early years.
Yeah, so I mean, I've always loved studying and learning new things. So I took quite a long roundabout way to become a doctor, in that my first degree was psychology, and then I enjoyed that enough to end up doing a PhD in psychology. So that was another few years of doing that. And then when I finished the PhD, I realized that actually I don't really like that much. And I want to go to medical school. So I enrolled at medical school. So then eventually I became a doctor at the age 33. So that was really my first full-time job, was at the age 33. So you can imagine my superannuation isn't very big so far. But
you've got two doctors. Are you a doctor, Mark Bordell?
Yeah, so a PhD.
Is that how we should address you, doctor?
So just as Mark, I hate when people call me doctor. But yeah, so I mean, that's took me quite a long time to get to where I wanted to be. And then when I became a doctor, I decided, oh, I probably want to be a surgeon, which is probably even quite a competitive route to get into. So after, and then halfway through doing that, after a few years of doing that in the UK, I decided to move to Australia, which was probably a good move in the long run.
And a work opportunity.
Yeah. And so that's how
I met Joanne.
And I met Joanne, yep.
Can't forget that detail. Now, in the process of you training as well, you actually did an elective in one of the poorest countries of the world. Do you want to tell us where that was and what prompted that?
Yeah, so I did it with a SIM, a serving admission, and it was in Niger, N-I-G-E-R, which is a country most people have never heard of.
So not Nigeria, but
nope.
Niger.
No, so it's north of Nigeria. So it's just, so it's a Muslim country majority, and it's quite close to where Boko Haram were working. And it also had Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which were just north of there. And Libya was collapsing around that time too. So it was there was a coup in the country, I think the week before I arrived. So it was pretty, I thought, well, if I can work my way through this, I can work my way through anything. It's a fantastic country to work in, but it's bottom of the list for most things. So like, you know, life expectancy, women dying in labor is very high there, and so and very, very poor country. I mean, in some ways it made me appreciate a lot more what we have in our Western countries, the availability of things. You know, you would see children coming through the door with cancers that would be have a 95 to 99% chance of survival in the West, whereas in Niger it was a death sentence for them. So it was,
wow.
4 months or so I was there, and definitely an eye opener, but also a bigger idea of what people do have in this world, and sometimes what, you know, the fullness of the spectrum of disease that you can see too.
Yeah. So I guess given our series in Genesis at the moment, you really saw the pains of creation, the effects of the fall of life outside of the garden.
Yeah.
What sort of impact did that have on you personally and on your faith as well?
Yeah. I was told my first day there, I was just out of medical school, so I, as junior as you can get, I was told by quite a senior doctor who's a professor of pulmonology in Little Rock, Arkansas, don't worry, we're all out of adepts here, so you'll just be the same as us, which probably isn't the most reassuring thing. But you feel out of your depth medically, but also your faith can be really hit by this, the amount of suffering you see around you. I think probably in retrospect, it was I wouldn't recommend many people to do that as their first exposure to medicine. And it did make me think a lot about my faith. But I did feel that, if you look at what Jesus did, he was, you know, the best surgeon, the best doctor, the best social worker, best philosopher you had in town. And he was also retouched by the suffering around him, which would have been quite similar to what I saw in Niger. You know, part of the reasons I became a doctor was because of the example that Jesus gave in healing people, and the way you can actually share the gospel when you're able to help people in a very difficult situation.
Yeah, we have a Jesus who didn't back away from all those things or retreat, but actually got his hands dirty and was filled with compassion, was moved in his guts to those who were harassed and helpless. Is there a particular story of an opportunity to share the gospel, be it with one of the patients that you were there, that you'd be happy to share?
So a lot of the work we had to do was through translators. What is quite interesting, I think, I can tell you about this, the hospital, is that where the hospital was built, there was no Christians at all. There were just the SAM in the 1940s, 1950s were allowed to build a hospital there by the French, who were currently the colonizers at the time, because they thought it was the most inhospitable place to build a hospital. For one, the temperature goes between pretty much 40 degrees and 50 degrees Celsius all year round. It's a volcanic plug, and there's pretty much no one there. But SAM was like, okay, we'll run with this. And actually, there's a Thai village that is built around this, and you can see how the gospel has changed. I mean, it's basically the tiniest, I wouldn't say Bible belt, but it's a very tiny Bible spot in a country that is mostly Muslim. You can see the change that the gospel has made in lives there. It's also quite interesting that all the diabetics in the country actually live around this hospital, because it's the only place they can get insulin because of the fridge and the generator we had to keep the insulin. So we were kind of keeping these people alive, and a lot of them had become Christians as a result of this ministry of getting the insulin to keep them alive.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful to hear about the way that God brings people to himself, and the heart of SIM to want to reach out to those folk. Now, you're in the midst of taking a sabbatical. You've been working as a doctor for 10 years. We're now moving out of Niger to Nepean, so to speak now. Yep. During the last year, you've given birth, or not you personally, but Joanne has given birth to a beautiful son, Elijah. Now, you guys chose to Mark chose to take that sabbatical for a year. But Joanne, if I could ask you, you know, you were working in midwifery and now you're a new mum. What's that experience like for you?
Yeah, so I actually had asked Mark to take the sabbatical because I did end up suffering with postnatal depression once I had Elijah. And being a midwife, I knew what the signs and symptoms of it, and I knew I was at risk of developing it, and it still ended up happening. So then we made a deal that if we were to ever have a second child, I'd want Mark to take the year off so he could be around to sort of give me that support with the second baby. And that's how he ended up having the year off.
Good on you, Mark. That's a husband who knows what he's doing and listens to his wife. And also well done, Joanne, for communicating that and not suffering in silence, so to speak.
Yeah. It's very hard for, even though I was never formally diagnosed, like it definitely was postnatal depression just because of the way that I was feeling towards my child. It took me a long time to actually connect with him. Just hearing his cries would really stress me out, and I would think of doing like harmful things to my baby, even though like I knew it was wrong and I knew the reason why behind it. It's really hard to reach out and get the support that you need to actually admit that you have postnatal depression.
Yeah.
In the first place.
And as you said, as a midwife, you knew the symptoms, you were counseling and advising people of what to be aware of, and you yourself accepting that that's what you were going through.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for sharing about that and giving us a window into what life is like. I mean, one of the values here at MBM is that we don't do pretend. So I really appreciate you opening up. And if that's a blessing to anyone else who's hearing, then please do reach out. Is there anything that you would recommend of someone who's maybe feeling that same way?
So there is actually at the back of the blue book that you get when you give birth, there is a hotline that you can call for perinatal anxiety and depression. And then when you see the midwife at home or when you see the community nurses, they do ask you questions about how you're feeling, and they do offer for you to get counselling and mental health support. So there are like places you can reach out to. But I would say the most helpful thing I found was actually having a mother's group and actually sharing my experiences with other mothers who were going through exactly the same thing that I was, and just knowing that I wasn't alone in this situation.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's part of it, isn't it? You can feel like you're alone, but actually as you express those things and hear the stories of other mums, then you know you're not alone and you can contact each other.
Yeah, and everyone's going through the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in amongst all this story, Mark, your mum had a bit of a health scare in the midst of the last 12 months, and that's been a journey in itself. Can you give us a window into what that's been like?
Yeah, so just before Christmas, we were at a Christmas party with some friends of ours, and I got a message from my dad, who in a typical fashion was trying not to worry us, but was telling us that my mum had become quite unwell, and he was taking her to hospital. It rapidly became clear to me that she was very, very unwell, and I got a call from the doctor late that night saying that she'd had a major bleed into the third ventricle of her brain. So that's quite deep inside the brain. And she'd gone into a coma, and they had to intubate her, which is to put a tube into her lungs and basically breathe for her. So we had to drop everything and travel back to France. At that point, I'd made my peace that she was going to die, and I was going back for a funeral.
Yeah, and that must have been that's a long way away to go on a plane, and just the emotions that you would have must have been feeling on the way over there. Am I going to make it in time?
I mean, maybe I'm not sure if it was because of my faith or it was because of, I know my mum's faith, or because I'm a doctor. I wasn't really as stressed. I mean, maybe it's very matter of fact saying, well, this is probably her time to leave us, sadly, and that's it. Mm-hmm. As we were on the plane, actually, I got a message from my brother saying that she'd improved quite dramatically. And by the time we arrived in France, she had woken up, so they'd extubated her, and she'd... So I need to say that in this situation, usually the patients, about at least 80%, depending on the type of bleed you had, and she had quite a bad bleed, 80% of people die or end up in a permanent vegetative state. Wow. And then the majority of the people after that end up with some, severe paralysis or unable to speak or sometimes locked-in syndrome where they can't do anything for themselves. And a very small minority have no symptoms at all. And in my mother's case, she's ended up going back home with no symptoms at all. although it has ups and downs, obviously. Just before she went home, the neurosurgeon told me she could see a brain tumor in my mum's brain, which is they thought that was the cause of the bleed, and that we'd have to do an MRI again in March to see the progress of that tumor. And she was quite sure about it, although no one else had picked up that tumor at that point. So at that point, we were all happy about her coming home, but then we had to kind of realize there was a strong potential she had a tumor. But then she had a repeat MRI in March, and then they couldn't see any tumor there at all. So we're not sure there was never a tumor in the first place, or it was obscured by the blood, and that made it look like a tumor. But now she's been given a clean bill of health, and she's didn't have to follow up at all any further from that point of view.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Geez, I was bracing myself there for another setback, but she's back to normal.
Yeah.
I would describe it almost like a miracle, because I've looked after these patients in intensive care, and I've seen, just especially considering where the bleed was, I thought we were going to France for a funeral, and even if she did recover, she would be severely disabled or in a coma or something. So I was absolutely amazed that she recovered with no deficits at all.
Yeah. I mean, initially she was a bit confused, but then you do tend to get that for quite some time. So, but within, 2 weeks, she was back to normal. Mm.
Yep. I'd take 2 weeks of confusion getting back to full health rather than the other options that you've outlined, but we have a good God. Yeah. France is not the only place that you've visited recently. You also have been to the UK and to Italy in amongst the outbreak of coronavirus.
That's right.
So we're going to dive into this story a little bit more detail now. You guys were actually there to visit family and friends in the UK for about a month. And then the plan was to go to Italy for another month.
Yep.
The Lombardy region, north
yep.
of Italy. So Milan, Venice had just started to go into quarantine, and you changed your travel plans to head south instead to Pisa and to Florence. And that's when you discovered that the rest of the country became in lockdown.
Well, it was supposed to be 2 months. 1 month was supposed to be my month of visiting my family and friends in the UK.
And Italy was supposed to be my month of traveling, one of my favorite countries.
So I got my month. So I was happy at least.
And maybe in a couple of years' time, when it's safe to travel again, Joanne can go back to Italy.
Yeah. It's a shame, but...
But you were there for a week, basically.
Yeah.
So we had to rejig the holiday. So initially we were going to do Venice, Milan, Florence, and Rome. But we dropped Milan anyway due to my brother giving a very bad review of it. So we're going to do Venice, Florence. But Venice was becoming too much of a hot spot at that point. I was worried about being locked down. So we cancelled the Venice booking.
Yep, and you cancelled the gondola ride.
Yeah, but we still flew into Venice because I'd already booked the ticket, so I wasn't going to waste my ticket. So we flew over to Venice and then got in a car immediately and drove down to Pisa. So we had 5 days in Pisa, which was very empty, no tourists at all.
It was great, actually, in terms of tourism for us.
And we managed to visit a few of the towns nearby, San Gimignano, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Some places in Tuscany.
But, yeah. Mm. And then moved on to Florence, and that's when things went south.
Mm. So started going a bit pear-shaped.
They locked down all the museums and churches first, and then that was on the Sunday. Then Tuesday morning we woke up to find out that the entire country was in lockdown.
Yeah. So you wake up on that Tuesday morning, you hear the news, you're there, and Joanne, we should say, actually, you're pregnant with your second at the moment.
Yep.
Who's 6 weeks away from delivery, and you've got he's not quite one at this point in time. You wake up at 7 a.m. on the Tuesday morning, you hear that the country's in lockdown. What do you do?
So at that point, I think all of my childhood spent worrying about nuclear fallout and worrying about every single possible thing kind of came quite handy. So I was able to elaborate a plan quite rapidly.
You worked quite fast, actually, to get everything sorted.
Yeah, so we had to. So the problem was our flight was going out of Rome. And so we had to, I wanted to get out that day because I realized if this is lockdown, we may end up with a baby being born in Italy at this rate. So,
which might be great for future travel purposes, but yeah, probably not at this point in time. Yeah. Okay. When was the flight booked out of Rome originally?
End of March. So I had 3 weeks to go. So at that point, I realized, okay, let's get out of here ASAP. So everything was working really rapidly in my brain. The problem is that when I start, it's like in an emergency in surgery, you become quite a rude person and you can see the light at the end of a tunnel, but you don't really care too much about who you're kind of pushing out of the way to get to the end of the tunnel.
Who you're going to offend.
So you're going to offend. So I was probably a bit snappy. And so I booked a vehicle, a car to drive from Florence to Rome, but that was on the other side of Florence. And so I had to walk over there, check that they were still open, which thankfully they were, secure the car, then walk back to the house. And because all of the center of Florence is a tourist area, you can't actually drive a car through there. So we had to take all the cases, the baby and Joanne, walk all the way to where the car was, a 30-minute walk.
So 30-minute walk with a less than one-year-old, and you're carrying all the luggage with you to your rental car.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was already sweating from the initial walk anyway. So I was, so I knew Florence pretty well by that point. So we pop in the car.
And it's a three-hour drive to Rome.
Three-hour drive to Rome and the lockdown. So I was worried that given the country was in lockdown, everybody was going to be heading to the airport and trying to get out. Pedal to metal, went to Rome within the legal speed limit, trying to get on the phone to Emirates, but no one answering the phone to try and get our ticket changed. So I thought, well, I don't know, we just have to get out of here with a pregnant wife and a young baby. I just didn't want to spend any more time there.
And we get lost trying to find a petrol station to fuel the car.
So, oh, you're going to return that rental car on full petrol. You don't want to pay extra.
Correct. So, so again, my money saving almost costed the flight in that sense. But so we arrive after we finally found the petrol and fill up the car with 70 minutes before the flight takes off. So bearing in mind,
70 minutes.
70, yeah.
Okay.
So I put Elijah into the baby carrier and in the front to get the maximum sympathy that I can, and then I go up to the Emirates desk and say, hey, any chance I can get on this flight and you can change our ticket? And surprisingly, they made a few phone calls and they got us on the flight.
And this was the last Emirates flight out of Rome for the day?
For the day, yeah. And we weren't sure if any more flights wouldn't come in because it was in shutdown, so a lot of companies were not wanting to fly planes in that may end up being blocked there because it's just Italy closing down at this time. This before the whole world was closing down.
But the other thing was we didn't know that Australia had locked off its borders to everyone who wasn't a citizen. And Mark was traveling on his British passport.
Well, I don't know about you, but I need to take a breath after hearing Mark and Joanne's story so far. As if things weren't stressful enough, what a day it has been. They've woken up in Florence, packed up a house, brought along a one-year-old and one in the womb, hired a car and driven 3 hours to Rome. Now at the airport with a ticket in hand and a family together, it looks like that is the end of the journey. Only for one last hurdle. Mark travelling with a British passport and Australia having closed its borders. Now, how did the Boydells make it back to the country? Well, you're going to have to tune in next week as we hear the rest of their wonderful story. But as we close out this episode with Mark and Joanne still in Rome, and after hearing about more than just an escape from Italy, also hearing about postnatal depression, the roller coaster of a parent suffering a major bleed in the brain, I think it's only fitting that we end with the words from Romans 12, verse 12, "Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer." Mark and Joanne have been a beautiful example of that very verse as they've shared their story today. Well, that's it for now. Make sure you tune in next week as we continue the rest of this story. But in the meantime, keep on trusting Jesus in your onward and upward journey.